important for people to understand that the vast majority of these people are Palestinians who've never been convicted of a crime. Israel has a system in which is called administrative detention, whereby people can be picked up and held without charge, without trial for 6 months at a time, and that detention then renewed indefinitely. So many of the people who are on this list fall into that category. There are five children that are under the age of 14, and a number of women as well. I think it's very important for people to understand that this is not a normal legal system, but it's a system where Israel has had a 95 to 99% conviction rate, and people are not tried in a regular court. They're tried in what's called a military court. Again, it's really sad that it's gotten to this point. This is why so many Palestinians have been pushing the international community to pressure Israel to release these individuals, because they shouldn't be languishing in prisons in any case, and certainly not children.
Considering what you mentioned, how long it's taken to even get to this point, what does this possibly, this deal possibly happening, mean for maybe the prospect of more release of more captives?
Well, certainly, I hope that that's going to be the next step. And within this agreement, from the text that I've seen so far, there is talk of releasing more in exchange for more. Again, this is where international involvement is so vital and so necessary. It shouldn't be the situation where it's just Palestinians versus Israelis, and that Palestinians have to be pushing for their prisoners to be released. There should be international involvement to end this system of military detention. So I'm certainly hopeful that this will lead to more, but of course it has to be coupled with a complete cessation, a complete ceasefire.
Deanna Buttu is a Palestinian human rights lawyer and analyst. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more coverage and for differing views and analysis of the conflict, go to npr.org/Middle East. And we'll note here, the Gaza Health Ministry says it can no longer provide an accurate count of deaths in Gaza since October 7th, and the United Nations says its last verified total is 11,078. In the middle of the Thanksgiving travel rush, a crash along the U.S. border with Canada yesterday put people on alert from the White House to Ottawa. A speeding vehicle went airborne and plowed into a busy checkpoint at Niagara Falls, New York. The explosion that followed killed two people inside the vehicle, and it prompted authorities to shut down other New York border crossings and stop international flights from leaving or arriving at the closest airport in Buffalo. Then, hours later,
at this time, there is no indication of a terrorist attack.
Even so, New York Governor Kathy Hochul said the precautions were warranted.
This is one of the busiest crossings, not just in Western New York, but along the entire U.S.-Canadian border. And it happens on the busiest travel day of the year. So naturally, in a time of heightened alert, everyone spring into action.
A security camera revealed a white vehicle speeding toward a line of booths at the checkpoint before hitting a low median and flying high into the air, twisting as it went.
It crashed into a Customs and Border Patrol booth, and the car and the booth immediately exploded. Burst into flames. I saw the video of an airborne vehicle that was absolutely surreal. You actually had to look at it and say, was this generated by AI? Because it was so surreal to see.
Despite the force of the crash and explosion, one person inside a border protection booth escaped serious harm.
The booth literally protected that individual. They went to the hospital with minor injuries and have been released.
The Rainbow Bridge crossing is still closed for an investigation, which the FBI has now turned over to local police. There's one situation where many parents can use a bit of help: how to soothe an upset child. Most parenting advice focuses largely on what to say to calm down a little one. But all around the world, many parents turn to another tactic. As NPR's Michaeline Duclef finds, this strategy is totally silent.
In Korea, parents may call it
yaksan.
In Taiwan, you can say
shusho.
And in Delhi, India, you may say
malish.
But in Latin America, parents may have the best name of all, piojito.
I love piojito. I love piojito. I asked the kids to give me piojito. I think it's my love language, piojito.
That's Joe Grajeda. He's 40 years old, owns a coffee shop in Alpine, Texas, and is a good friend of mine. Grajeda was born and raised in northern Mexico. He says that in Spanish, piojito literally means
the lice, or like a little lice.
But the word also means gently caressing a person you love. To give piojito, Grajeda says,
you scratch somebody's back or their head with the tip of your fingers very lightly. You do it very soft, and you kind of want to make the skin kind of crawl a little bit. What do you call that?
Like with goosebumps.
Yes, like goosebumps. We call it chicken skin in Mexico.
When Grajeda was a little boy, he fondly remembers his mom giving him piojito at night.
She would start scratching my head, and that would make me go to sleep.
Now, after decades of research, neuroscientists have started to understand why this type of touch, this tickly touch, is so effective at soothing and calming kids, probably better than trying to console them with words. Ismail Abdul-Sabor is a neurobiologist at Columbia University. He says that our skin contains special neurons to detect this particular touch, and they turn on only when you caress at a particular speed, when it's slow.
So if you rush across the skin surface too quickly, that might actually be perceived as aversive.
Back in February, Abdul-Sabor and his colleagues published a landmark study in the journal Cell, showing how these neurons signal to the brain. In mice, they showed how
these neurons in the skin basically have a dedicated highway, a neuronal highway, pathway to the brain's reward centers.
So turning on these neurons makes the animal want to be touched like this more. Other research in humans shows that turning on these neurons feels good to most people, reduces their pain perception, lowers their heart rate, and may release naturally occurring opioids inside their brain. Abdul-Sabor says our bodies are wired up to receive this type of touch and calm down this way.
Exactly. From people to animals, when they're sick or in pain, you want to rub the area. You want to go to a loved one and get that social touch, that rub, you know?
Together, the research indicates that these special nerves are part of a system inside of our skin that trigger the warm, peaceful feeling you have when you're with people who love you. Helena Huasling is a neuroscientist at Sahlgrenska University Hospital in Gothenburg, Sweden. She says this touch is critical for helping children feel safe.
Being touched is also something that is just a basic need. It's like having had dinner. When you are hungry, you need to have that input in order for you to reach an equilibrium, good, steady state.
She says that Western society has had a long history of telling parents not to touch their children. Psychologists and doctors have said that touching kids can weaken them or prevent them from becoming independent. But Huasling says,
turns out that the actual opposite is true. That children who get a lot of touch and closeness from their parents actually are the ones that dare to go out and explore because they have a basic safety that they can rely on. They have a solid foundation.
That's why Joe Grajeda, over here in Alpine, says he gives all his children piojito.
As soon as they get close to me and I grab them, I hug them, and I start scratching their back. And they like to sit there and just kind of enjoy the moment.
Knowing that all their needs are met and their dad loves them. I'm Michaeline Duclef for NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8:19 on this Thanksgiving Thursday. Glad you're along with us this morning. So that deal between Israel and Hamas that was supposed to put a four-day pause on the war and have some hostages released, that was obviously set back. It did not happen this morning. Qatar just releasing a statement now saying that truce is set to go into place at midnight Eastern time tonight. That'll be at about 11 o'clock Central time. We'll have more coming up in news in about 11 minutes on WPR.
About half of all consumers say that this year they have less money to spend on gifts. And that has retailers thinking,
how can I be first out of the box and get the money that people have to spend on gifts?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a retailer's read on this year's holiday shopping season. That's next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace tonight and each weeknight at 6:30 here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Bernie's Rock Shop, featuring rock tumblers, lapidary tools, and jewelry-making supplies for rock hounds and crafters of all ages. 901 East Johnson in Madison. Holiday hours are at Bernie's Facebook page.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
On Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather today, mostly sunny for the Thanksgiving holiday. Highs in the 30s and 40s throughout the day today. Temperatures down to the teens and 20s overnight, so it's going to get pretty cold. Tomorrow, still cold. Highs in the 20s and 30s across the state. On Saturday and Sunday, more of the same, with a chance for flurries in the north. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Rockefeller Foundation, making opportunity universal and sustainable for over 100 years. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. It's been half a century and Charlie Brown still has not figured it out. Do not trust Lucy.
Come on, Charlie Brown. I'll hold the ball and you kick it.
She wouldn't try to trick me on a traditional holiday.
This is a scene from a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. The holiday special is celebrating its 50th anniversary.
This time I'm gonna kick that football clear to the moon!
Dog!
Isn't it peculiar, Charlie Brown, how some traditions just slowly fade away?
Not this one. Charlie Brown Thanksgiving has been around since 1973. It's based on the classic characters from the comic strip Peanuts, created by Charles Schulz.
The plot of a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving is so fun, and we can all relate to it even 50 years later.
That is Gina Hunsinger, director of the Charles Schulz Museum in Santa Rosa, California.
Peppermint Patty calls Charlie Brown, and she invites herself over for Thanksgiving.
I don't mind inviting myself over because I know you kind of like me, Chuck. See you soon, you sly devil.
Oh, brother.
Now what?
Peppermint Patty's coming to Thanksgiving dinner.
We won't even be home.
Charles Schulz died in 2000, and last year, on what would have been his 100th birthday, I spoke with his widow, Jeannie Schulz, along with Gina Hunsinger of the Schulz Museum. Jeannie, how did Charles, or Sparky as he was known, how did he come up with the idea for Peanuts?
I guess that he drew a cartoon called Little Folks. They were panel cartoons, and they were just little kid cartoons. One of the principals at Art Instruction School, where he worked as a corrector of people's art lessons, said, I think you should stick with the little kids. That's what he turned in to all the syndicates to see if he could get a contract. Little kids, no parents, simple, simple, simple.
Yeah, that, I think that was the genius part of Peanuts, is that no parents, no grown-ups. It was just focused on the kids. Gina, what do you think made Schulz different from other cartoonists?
First of all, he was a genius. We could relate to his strip. Like, we could see ourselves as Charlie Brown. You know, our kite's stuck in the tree again, or the frustration of, you know, something happening. And also, Charles Schulz was the first one to really talk about emotions in the strip. So it changed the cartooning industry with his influence. He was so different than what was on the page when he first started. The other thing that he was different was that his aesthetic, his lines were minimal. He only put what was necessary to tell a story, and it just jumped off the page compared to the cartoon strips of the time when he started in 1950.
You know what I like about Peanuts is that being a kid is difficult, because, you know, you're not fully formed yet. So you make mistakes. Things that would seem like not a big deal to an adult are a really big deal to a little kid.
Right.
Kids are just messy. And I think that was something that really took hold.
Yes. I feel like we've been listening to so many people talk around the centennial. And one of the cartoonists said, you know, people were trying to sell us things all the time. Like, you're supposed to be happy and you're supposed to do this. And Charles Schulz sort of said it like it was. So people were like, yeah, I get these characters. I feel a part of this. They speak to me.
And we have so many people who come into the museum and say, you know, when I was a little kid, I used to run home from school, run into my room, close the door, and read those little peanut dollar paperbacks. And that was comforting to them. They just wanted to go home and suck their thumbs and read peanuts.
Now, I want to play another clip from a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. Now, in this scene, Sally sees her big brother, Charlie, looking sad at the mailbox and asks him what's the matter.
Holidays always depress me.
I know what you mean. I went down to buy a turkey tree, and all they have are things for Christmas.
For Christmas already?
Anyway, why should I give thanks on Thanksgiving? What have I got to be thankful for?
Charlie Brown Thanksgiving has been around since 1973. Jeannie, why do you think its appeal has stuck around for so long?
I always say that Sparky expressed the human condition. He wrote about real emotions that kids are feeling. And it's always delivered with a little bit of humor. Anybody can read that strip in 4 seconds and get comfort from it because it talks about humanity.
Gina, how would you define his legacy?
Pervasive. I feel like he has influenced the world, you know, just from like security blanket in the dictionary to we have people from all over the world come and visit and they love peanuts.
Jeannie, how come no one has taken over the Peanuts comic strip after Charles's death? Or is that something that maybe no one would want to have that job to fill those massive shoes?
Well, that may be true, although I suspect there were people who would have liked to try. But Sparky, in his contract, said when he stopped drawing it, the strip would stop. What people see today are reruns. So you're seeing the same comic strips. And what amazes me is that it's still funny. You still want to read it right now. Snoopy's going to Needles or somewhere to find Spike. And it's just funny.
Jeannie, it sounds like you still read the comic.
Oh, I do. I actually still read the newspapers. I get a lot of fun out of looking through those when I do.
Gina, when people visit the Schulz Museum, what do they tell you is the reason why they come? Why do you think people still want to have peanuts in their lives?
The thing that people say the most to me is that they actually feel like there's some sort of comfort that they get from coming back to something that takes them back in time and it still makes them laugh. And I feel like they just want to come for a little comfort and happiness.
That's Gina Hunsinger, the director of the Schulz Museum in Santa Rosa, California, and also Jeannie Schulz, the wife of Charles Schulz. Jeannie and Gina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abe.
This is NPR News.
Millions of Americans are on the road this Thanksgiving, gathering with family and friends for the annual feast. And that raises a question, sweet potato or pumpkin pie?
Even though pumpkins were available in the South, sweet potato becomes the one of choice. And I think maybe that has something to do with the African presence.
History, cultural ties, and pie on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on WPR on this Thanksgiving holiday. It's 8:29. Officials in Qatar are giving an update on the proposed truce between Israel and Hamas. That's ahead in news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A four-day pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas will begin tomorrow. That's according to officials in Qatar who've been mediating talks between the two sides. They provided an update a short time ago. Until then, NPR's Lauren Freyer says the war goes on.
An Israeli military spokesperson says forces continue to bomb Gaza, some 300 targets there in the past 24 hours. He says they're using ground forces, drones, and precision-guided missiles. Israel says this is all aimed at destroying Hamas.
That deal calls for Hamas to release 50 hostages taken during the militants' attack in southern Israel on October 7th. In exchange, Israel is to free 150 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. The FBI says there's no indication terrorism had anything to do with yesterday's deadly vehicle crash and explosion at a checkpoint along the U.S.-Canadian border. Investigators say the vehicle was traveling at a high rate of speed when it crashed on the U.S. side of the Rainbow Bridge at Niagara Falls. Two people inside the vehicle were killed. A new report says electric vehicle sales in the U.S. will hit a record high this year. According to the group Atlas Public Policy, EV sales will make up 9% of all vehicle sales in the country for 2023. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Wisconsin is on pace to have more than 16,000 car deer accidents this year. That would be similar to the last 3 years. State Department of Natural Resources Deer Program Specialist Jeff Pritzel says since the late 90s, the concentration of deer has been shifting towards the southern part of the state.
The trend we've been seeing over the last couple of decades in southern Wisconsin is that the deer harvest simply hasn't been keeping up with the productivity of the deer herd. And so that plays out in why there's, you know, a growing issue as far as the conflict with accidents on the road.
Urban counties in the southern part of the state, like Dane and Waukesha, have routinely been in the top five counties for car deer accidents in recent years. Most of these crashes happen in October and November. That's when deer are on the move during the mating season known as the rut. Drivers are encouraged to slow down and put down their phones to avoid crashes. Democratic Governor Tony Evers is issuing more pardons. The governor's office announced yesterday that 82 people will be granted a pardon. Most of them were convicted of nonviolent offenses like possessing marijuana or trying to cash a fake check. Evers has now pardoned more than 1,000 people since taking office. His predecessor, former Republican Governor Scott Walker, did not issue a single pardon during his two terms in office. According to the Wisconsin State Journal, the act of pardoning someone restores their rights, such as voting, owning a gun, and serving on a jury, but it does not erase court records. A silver alert has been issued statewide for a missing 73-year-old Kenosha man. WKOW-TV reports that John West has been diagnosed with early-onset dementia, Alzheimer's, and sundowners. He was last seen on Wednesday evening, leaving work at a pick-and-save grocery store near the Kenosha area. He's likely in a vehicle. It's a black 2012 Dodge Avenger with Wisconsin license plates. John is described as a black man standing 5'7" with a partially gray goatee. Anyone who thinks they see him is asked to contact the Kenosha Police Department. In weather today, highs in the 30s and 40s across the state. Plenty of sunshine for the holiday as well. Nice and light winds across the state. Tonight, temperatures getting down into the teens and 20s. Eventually, high temperatures reaching the 20s and 30s throughout the rest of the weekend. A chance for some flurries Saturday and Sunday in the north. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing how communities are restoring trust and solving problems on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. For most of us, banks are where we keep our checking accounts or where we go to get a mortgage or a car loan. But as we learned in the Great Depression, in the global financial crisis of the mid-2000s, and also with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank this past March, when banks get in trouble, the whole economy shakes. That's why the Federal Reserve and other banking regulators want big banks to hold bigger capital cushions so they're less likely to fail. Now, this proposal is drawing intense criticism from the banks. To explain what it's all about, we turn to David Wessel. He's director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. So, David, first tell us, what exactly is bank capital?
Bank capital is the amount of money that bank shareholders have invested in the business. It's a cushion that can absorb losses if borrowers don't pay back the loans, so banks have enough money to cover consumer deposits. If banks don't have enough capital when things go wrong, and they certainly didn't have enough back in 2007, then they either fail or get bailed out by the government, and the economy suffers because it takes time for the banks to return to health so they can lend again.
All right, so that's bank capital. What's at stake then? Not just for bank stockholders, but for all of us, the rest of us.
The bankers tell us that if they're forced to have too much capital, if their government requires them to take out too much insurance, they'll end up lending less, and that'll hurt the economy. The rest of us, though, want banks to hold enough capital so they're unlikely to fail, not so much that we can't get loans, and that's a tricky balance.
All right, so what exactly then are federal regulators proposing now?
Well, in the years following the global financial crisis, regulators made the banks hold more capital, and they're now proposing to make the 37 banks hold still more, about 16% on average, more for the very biggest banks. Now, the proposal is incredibly complicated. It fills 316 pages of small type in the Federal Register. But basically, banks that have the riskiest portfolios of loans and securities would have to hold more capital. And the regulators want to make a lot of technical changes to the way the banks calculate the amount of capital they need to have, mainly relying less on internal bank models and more on standard models imposed by the regulators.
And why aren't the banks happy about this?
Well, look, the more capital a bank has to hold, the harder it is for them to make money. So the big banks have launched an unusually public and aggressive campaign. Now, they know they're not going to win much support by talking about the impact this is going to have on their bottom lines. So they're focused on the impact this is going to have on the economy, on small businesses, on mortgage borrowers. It's amazing. They've launched websites with URLs like AmericansCan'tAffordIt.com. And one political action committee, siding with the banks, even ran a TV ad on a Sunday NFL game saying that the capital rules raise costs to consumers. Now, proponents of the tougher capital rules, including the regulators, say, look, the banks are exaggerating this. The costs are modest compared to the benefits of reducing the risk of banking crisis that can have long-lasting, really bad effects on the economy.
So as I understand it, capital requirements are made by the regulators, not by Congress. Still, though, politics are definitely involved in this. So what's that like?
Absolutely. The banks have really raised this to a political issue, and it's very polarized. On the Fed board, 2 of 6 governors voted against even putting the proposal out for comment. On the Federal Deposit Insurance Board, 2 of the 5 directors also voted against it. All of the no votes were from Republicans. All the Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee have signed a letter blasting the regulators. Democrats are split. Some have expressed reservations, but others, including the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, are standing behind the regulators.
So what happens now?
Well, the regulators are going to take comments until January of next year. Revisions are very likely, tweaking some of the details and probably scaling back some of the most controversial elements.
All right, that's David Wessel. He's director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. David, thanks.
You're welcome.
If you are one of the tens of millions of Americans traveling for the holidays this year, you'll be spending plenty of time at airports. Now, one in particular is receiving some high honors. The restrooms at Baltimore Washington International Airport were just declared the best in the business this year. WYPR's Scott Massioni took a trip to the Louvre to see exactly what makes them so special for the 24 million people who go through that airport each year.
BWI's bathrooms on Concourse B are brightly lit with natural light. They have lights above the stalls that tell you which are occupied, and the stall doors reach all the way to the floor.
We also put in sensors for our custodial staff that would actually tell them where we're running low on soap.
Paul Schenk, BWI's chief engineer, says the toilet paper rolls have high-tech sensors too. And he's probably spent more time thinking about bathrooms in the last couple years than many of us will in our lives. Schenk and his team conducted surveys, talked to custodial staff, studied innovative restroom designs, and even thought through the best cleaning processes for BWI's $55 million bathroom overhaul.
The two national surveys said restrooms are the most important thing to the passengers, which blows my mind. And another survey said it was the second most important. So restrooms are both the number one and number two most important thing for our traveling public.
Paul's down with the potty humor, if you can't tell. And all that thought that he put into how we do our business, well, it won BWI the CentOS Award for America's Best Bathroom of 2023. That's a contest that's been going strong since 2002. 10 finalists are nominated for the best bathroom each year, and then voting's open to the general public, where hundreds of thousands of people chime in. Schenk says what makes BWI's bathroom so special is more than just technology. There's also ambiance. In BWI's lavatory, there's no noisy hair dryers, just the satisfying crisp pull of a paper towel. Then, of course, there's cleanliness.
What we went with was all glass. It's an impervious surface. It's easy to disinfect. It's easy to clean. And it looks ultra modern. It's bright. It's shiny.
Schenk and his team took convenience into account, too, considering people are juggling luggage and sometimes kids. Annette Parks and her husband are traveling with their two children.
When you have toddlers, you have to, like, both fit into one stall.
And opening the door to get out, usually you're both squeezing up the side of against a stall or bumping into the toilet as you open the door.
But they found BWI's bathrooms to be a completely different experience.
At the changing station, hand sanitizer, a sink right there, and a trash can literally right there.
Parks wasn't the only one impressed. Grady Laura Monteroso is a student who frequently travels from Baltimore to Illinois.
I guess it's more of like the lighting and the privacy you get. It's like really clean immediately as soon as you walk in, which is hard to say about a lot of airport bathrooms.
So next time you're in BWI and looking for a quick pit stop or maybe even a little ambiance, don't skip the loo. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
Coming up later on All Things Considered, the writers and actors strikes are finally in the rearview mirror, and Hollywood's revving up for the holidays. Our film critic Bob Mondello brings us a preview of the award contenders, comedies, musicals, and comic book spectaculars coming to theaters. To hear the story, listen to NPR on your phone, smart speaker, or on your reliable radio. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you're along with us on this Thanksgiving holiday. It is 8:42 in the morning. Coming up here on the show, NPR's history podcast Throughline is going to look at how the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota avoided the fate of most reservations in the U.S. and continues to own all of the reservation land. We'll hear that story coming up on WPR. Quick check of the day's news headlines on the way.
Jump into playful learning during an autumn of exploration with PBS Wisconsin Education. Find free fun, educational games, activities, programs, and more at pbswisconsin.org/education. From learning time to play time and any time in between, spark a love of learning with PBS Wisconsin on your TV, tablets, and mobile devices. Start exploring today at pbswisconsin.org/education.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar. All Energy Solar is dedicated to offering residential and commercial solar energy solutions for home or office throughout Wisconsin. More at allenergysolar.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
On Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44, here's what's happening in news. That temporary ceasefire agreed to by Israel and Hamas has been delayed. Officials in Qatar who have been mediating these negotiations now say it is going to begin at midnight tonight Eastern time. That would be about 11 o'clock tonight Central time. About 13 women and children will be released right away when that time hits. It is also supposed to include 4 days of cease fighting. The FBI says terrorism had nothing to do with the fiery car crash near the U.S.-Canada border crossing. 2 people were killed in that crash. A state of emergency has been declared in one Kentucky county after the derailment of a train. 2 of the derailed cars contained sulfur and caught fire. That means that sulfur dioxide gas is being released into the air. About 200 people in the area have been encouraged to evacuate. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society in its hometown of Flint and communities around the world. More at mott.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. As family and friends gather around the table to celebrate Thanksgiving, it might feel impossible or really difficult not to discuss the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. So how should you wade into these conversations? Joining us now for some suggestions is John Della Volpe. He's the director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics and focuses on young Americans' political beliefs. Now, John, you recently wrote about this, and you used polling to kind of figure out exactly how different generations approach certain aspects of the conflict. So what's something that Zoomers and Boomers can agree on? Because on the surface, it doesn't seem like Gen Z and baby boomers have a lot of common ground.
That's right. 61% in the Quinnipiac poll said they just want to avoid conversations about politics with friends and families over Thanksgiving. However, as you said, easier said than done. And if trying to find common ground, if the issues of the day come up, the best advice I have, especially across generational lines, is to talk about the humanitarian assistance. That is a subject where younger people and their parents and their grandparents can generally find some common ground.
How do you do that, though? How do you shift from the more emotional parts of it to something that maybe doesn't seem like would be very emotional to talk about?
Well, I think talking about what they're concerned about and the idea that there are innocent civilians who are in need of humanitarian assistance on both sides of the border is something that really can try to diffuse a situation. Of course, you're not going to ever be able to avoid something with that crazy uncle necessarily on Thanksgiving. Yeah. But again, the purpose of my piece here is to say, if something happens, here's something that we can agree on and hopefully change the conversation to something, you know, like the weather.
What if things start to shift? What would be something that would give you red flags to think, okay, maybe we should stay away from this?
I think the idea of, quote, choosing sides is something that is the huge red flag. And that's really the most divisive of points today. And I'm not talking about sides of Hamas versus Israel. I'm talking about the idea of which side you're on, the Palestinian side or Israeli side. Overwhelmingly, the parents and grandparents of Gen Zers, teenagers, folks in their 20s, overwhelmingly by factors of 4 or 5x would say, I support the Israelis and not necessarily the Palestinians. Whereas for younger people, there is net support for, quote, the Israeli side, but it's far more nuanced. Almost as many also indicate support for Palestinians, which is essentially saying both sides. They see the humanitarian crisis that is happening and affecting so many people in the Middle East right now.
John, what if there's no way around it? And that is where this conversation is going around the dinner table. It can't get out of it. It's going to happen. From your experience, how should people handle these extremely difficult conversations?
I think that it's going to be very difficult to convince someone with this kind of conversation within this environment of their side. And I would always go back to the way in which they see it, their experience, their values. But again, you're not going to convince someone. I think moving it to things that we can agree on and perhaps have the conversation at a later point, we can agree on humanitarian assistance on both sides. We can agree on the freedom of speech. Both sides agree on that. And we can also agree that today and the next couple of days is not the best time to have this kind of conversation.
John Della Volpe is a pollster and author of Fight, How Gen Z is Channeling Their Fear and Passion to Save America. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. Glad to have you along at 8:49 on this Thanksgiving holiday. There's still plenty of stuff left to come in the program here this morning. We're going to hear that story from NPR's history podcast, Throughline, looking at the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota and how it avoided the fate of most reservations in the U.S., still continues to own all of its land. That's just ahead on WPR.
On Saturday morning, December the 2nd at 11:15, join us for the WGTD Radio Theater's holiday broadcast from Lake Lawn Resort. That's the WGTD Radio Theater, Saturday morning, December the 2nd at 11:15.
Classical and classics by request, visit WPR.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, Marquette's men's basketball team fell to Purdue in the championship of the Maui Invitational yesterday. The Badgers men's team did win the championship in the Fort Myers tip-off tournament. They beat SMU. Milwaukee Bucks lost to the Boston Celtics last night. The Bucks will play the Washington Wizards tomorrow. The Packers have a Thanksgiving Day game against the Lions that starts at 11:30 this morning. And the Badgers football team will take on Minnesota to wrap up the regular season Saturday. That one starts at 2:30 in the afternoon. In weather, highs in the 30s and 40s with plenty of sunshine across the state for this Thanksgiving holiday. Overnight, temperatures down into the teens and 20s, and it's going to be pretty cold for the remainder of the holiday weekend. Highs in the 20s and 30s tomorrow. Still dry with no snow expected. Could see a few flurries in the northern part of the state on Saturday and Sunday. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Very few Indian tribes in the United States actually own all of their reservation land. For more than 40 years, a federal policy called allotment carved up most reservations into private parcels. Only a handful of tribes avoided this, and keeping their lands changed their futures. NPR's Anya Steinberg and Sequoia Carrillo went to the Red Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota for NPR's history podcast, Throughline.
What's up, Red Lake?
If you take a drive through Red Lake, you will notice that, you know, they have their own justice center. They have their own police force, tribal government complex.
They have their own radio station.
We were big fans of WRLN. A lot of the road signs on the reservation are in Ojibwe first and English second. There's even a fishery that uses traditional indigenous techniques. We actually got to see it and smell it in action.
He just showed me the machine to descale. It's very, very cool.
In some parts of the reservation,
people bury their dead in the front yard.
This is Anton Troyer, author of the book Warrior Nation, A History of the Red Lake Ojibwe. Anton is a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and he grew up nearby.
That is very different than you'll find in most parts of America.
The reason Red Lake is so different from pretty much any reservation I've been to before is because of events that happened almost 150 years ago. It's June 29th, 1889. Red Lake's seven hereditary chiefs are gathered in a tiny government school building to meet with a commission sent by the United States. Red Lakers still held more than 3 million acres of land, while most tribes in Minnesota held less than 100,000.
And the U.S. wanted that land. On Red Lake's side, there was one man at the forefront of the negotiations.
He was made by nature one of the greatest men in mind and body that I think I have ever seen.
His name was Madway Ganonand.
Madway Ganonand, or he who is spoken to, as he was known in English, was often described by settlers as the head chief at Red Lake. When he arrived at the 1889 negotiations, he was 82 years old, and he carried with him a lifetime of loss and upheaval, a lifetime of dealing with Americans.
We wish that any land we possess should be not only for our own benefit, but for our grandchildren hereafter.
He's facing off against the U.S. Chippewa Commission, a group of three men. One, a missionary. Two, a surgeon. And last but not least, their leader, Henry Rice.
All that is desired by the government is that you will agree to what is best for yourselves.
Henry Rice was a well-known early Minnesota politician, and he was deeply involved in the Indian business.
Rice had negotiated treaties with groups of Ojibwe across Minnesota. And here he was, in 1889, to get the job done once again.
They wanted everybody living at Red Lake to cede all of their land.
And if they couldn't get them to do that,
to at least get them to take allotment.
Allotment was a federal policy that divided reservation land into privately owned parcels.
After parcels were allotted to tribal members, the remaining land was opened up for sale to settlers, farmers, and businessmen. The policy was framed as a win-win. White Americans could get access to valuable timber and farmland, and Native people could own their own land and a piece of the American dream.
But Medway Ganonan wasn't buying it.
Third Council at Red Lake. Wednesday, July 3rd, 1889.
Medway Ganonan said, look,
I wish to lay out a reservation here where we can remain with our bands forever.
We don't want to give up anything. And he knew that there was no way for them to avoid giving up something. But they would not give up everything.
I will never consent to the allotment plan.
As the negotiations dragged on, Henry Rice began to understand that Red Lake wasn't budging.
Fourth Council at Red Lake, July 4th. Fifth Council at Red Lake, July 5th. Sixth Council at Red Lake, July 6th, 1889.
They were not going to get Red Lakers to move off this land.
You must not expect to keep all your reservation.
It is not greediness that influences us.
And they actually had a map laid out on the table, and the tribal members drew lines around the lake, and they articulated in the agreement that all of the land around both Upper and Lower Red Lake and a mile of land around the lakeshore on all sides would be part of the reservation. So that was the understanding.
The commissioners and the hereditary chiefs reached a deal. Red Lake would cede millions of acres of land, but in exchange, the reservation would not be allotted. This moment was the fork in the road. It's when Red Lake's path diverges from the vast majority of reservations in the United States.
What happened next, we don't have great documentation for. But afterwards, Henry Rice took off.
He left Red Lake with the signed agreement and the map in hand.
Eventually made his way to Washington, D.C., and there was a map submitted. Either Henry Rice took the map he had in front of the natives, ripped it up, and submitted a different map, or submitted the map that was agreed to, and somebody else came in and swapped it out.
A corner was sliced off the reservation map. Whether or not it was by accident, we'll never know.
Medway Ganonan and the hereditary chiefs left the negotiation thinking they had kept the most important parts of their land, Upper and Lower Red Lake, and the forests around it. By the time they found out it had been stolen, it was too late.
Since the moment Red Lake's leaders discovered the fraud, they've been adamant about getting it back.
That was Anya Steinberg and Sequoia Carrillo for NPR's history podcast, Throughline. And you can listen to more on the topic wherever you get your podcasts.
This story from Throughline comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Alex Crow. Thanks so much for spending the start of your Thanksgiving morning with us here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock. The news is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, offering fall activities such as scenic tours, live entertainment, and indoor water in theme parks. WisDells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to improving lives and strengthening nonprofits, and guiding donors like you toward tax-advantaged giving to make a positive impact on the community. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.